My name is Jim Martin Schramm, and I teach theological ethics at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And this is the last of a series of three presentations that I've been giving in a series titled Population Perils. Today we're going to address, or I'm going to try to just run through some information about the nature of illegal immigration and immigration to the United States, but focusing primarily on illegal immigration. Hopefully this will provide at least some background information for the forum, which apparently will be tonight, focusing on these issues. I should say that my experience with these issues is from the perspective of an academic, rather than someone who lives in one of the six states that's primarily impacted by immigrant populations in the United States. I've also become more aware of the issue through my work with the Population and Consumption Task Force of the President's Council on Sustainable Development. One of the areas that we addressed was the issue of legal and illegal immigration, and I'll say more about that later, and it's the relationship of our task force to the Jordan Commission, which is a presidential commission working on immigration issues for about 7 years. So anyway, what I'm going to share with you today is primarily data that I think is fairly accurate. Most of it comes from the Population Reference Bureau in Washington, D.C., which is a fairly bipartisan, objective information gathering organization. Groups on both sides of the issue tend to cite their figures. So hopefully, at least the data I present will be objective. And then at the end, if we have time remaining, I'll just offer some theological perspectives on the issue, not that they will be definitive, but that they I just throw them out as my contribution. I leave today on the boat and won't be here for the forum tonight. So, all right, let's get started. If Jonathan Frericks were here, which I don't think he is, Jonathan works for LWR. In the early 90s, I saw a figure of about 40 million refugees in the world, but the Population Reference Bureau, in the most recent publication that I've seen, a 1995 publication, estimates that there are 100 million migrants and refugees wandering the world at some point during the 1990s. 25% of those folks are in North America, in other words, they wound up in North America. And 25% I have wound up in Western Europe, with the remainder being in other countries or in their own country, simply displaced within their own country as a result of war, famine, etc. Now that's a small number in terms of the total global population, 5.7 billion people, 100 million folks isn't that many, but it is plenty. It's certainly enough to tax nations and to cause nations like the United States to really wrestle with this immigration issue. So what are some of the factors related to migration? Scholars or experts talk about it in terms of push and pull factors. Various push factors are these. War and repression. Think about Rwanda and the conflict that broke out between the Hutus and the Tutsis, and everybody scattering into Tanzania, Zaire, neighboring nations. Poverty and landlessness. The United States saw a lot of Central Americans fleeing poverty and landlessness during the 80s, and will probably continue to see that happen over the course of the next decades. NAFTA, while it promises some hope in terms of jobs in the future, in the short term, both sides agreed that it's going to result in the displacement of many agricultural workers, especially in Mexico, and they're going to have to go somewhere. They'll probably first go to Mexico City or to other big cities, but after that, they'll probably head north, and that'll be pushed primarily by poverty and rural landlessness. Unemployment. Environmental degradation. This is, at least at this point, one of the push factors that people believe will be more significant in the next 50 years than it has been in the last 50 years, as land degradation gets more severe. For instance, Haiti. If you ever have an opportunity to see a satellite image of Haiti, it's really, or frankly, just a being on the ground in Haiti, the forests are almost gone, and as a result, the topsoil is washing off fragile slopes. And Haiti is a pretty prime example of environmental degradation, really forcing people to have to move around and adjusting. Famine and hunger has always been a problem and will continue to be. So those are at least some of the push factors. There are probably others. There are also pull factors. Peace and social stability, that is to say, many Central Americans during the 80s, for example, fled the region to get away from the civil war in El Salvador or repression in Guatemala. Economic opportunity and freedom, if you don't have much going for you. Higher wages related to economic opportunity, environmental integrity, and then family connections. The pull to be resettled with others who have gone before you is a very significant factor. One of the debates that was interesting to follow in Cairo at the International Conference on Population and Development last year was a debate over rights of repatriation. That is to say that nations in the developing world, some nations in the developing world were arguing that family members left behind after other members had migrated to other nations should have the right to be repatriated with their family members in those other countries. After all, family has been separated. Well, the nations, recipient nations, like the United States, member nations in the European Economic Union, said absolutely not. We're not interested in any kind of rights language here. No one has a right to enter our country. We are the ones that have a right to limit the number of people who enter our country. Yes?
Did you say settlement or repatriation?
I'm using those terms loosely there. But the rights language referred to allowing family members left behind to come to the nations where their family members are. Now, the U.S. has fairly liberal laws that allows that in the first place, but we didn't want the rights language put in there, which would then definitely obligate us. This is a tangent, but I just want to illustrate how this issue springs up in different international gatherings. But that's a major pull factor, to be reunited with your family. Questions about those? Any that aren't up there that occur to you that should be up there?
Well, there's a lot of people that come into France to get on the state social security.
Guest workers, you mean?
What's that?
Do you mean guest workers or no?
Well, there's a strong draw from the United States to give birth to a child.
Oh, yes. Right.
A U.S. citizen, so that they get on the welfare board.
That's right. So I, yeah, I mean, I suppose that would be under economic opportunity and freedom, but it's, yeah, you're right. If you're born in the United States, you're a U.S. citizen, whether your parents are from Mexico or Chile or wherever. Well, let's move on. General United States information, those are just some general factors related to migration. With the exception of Native Americans, every American is one of 60 million immigrants or their descendants. Now, Deanne, I'm not going to talk a lot about the history of U.S. immigration, but Deanne is modern church history scholar, and can certainly cover all of that kind of data for you. What's that?
Only up to the 1920s.
Well, that's far enough. I'm going to talk pretty much after that. So, that's an important thing for us to realize. We all stem either from colonists, slaves. Slaves formed 19% of the U.S. population in 1790, or immigrants. And of course, the vast majority of us are the ancestors of immigrants. Then the U.S. accepts about half of the world's immigrants per year. At least this is what the Population Reference Bureau says. And so I'm going to focus primarily on U.S. The U.S. reality rather than talk about France or Germany or Spain or other nations. So that's an important reality to keep in mind as this debate rages in terms of fair share. Okay, the current U.S. immigration situation. By the way, I didn't pull this all together just for this session. This was a lecture I gave in a course in May. Okay, legal and illegal immigration adds up to about a million people per year in the United States. And I'll break that down in just a minute. That breaks down to approximately 3,000 people per day entering the United States, either legally or illegally. And this is primarily from Latin American and Asian countries. That's one of the big differences between immigration today and immigration 100 years ago. Is that the vast majority of immigrants today come from poor, developing nations whose skin color is not the same of those who entered here 100 years ago.
Ireland had a few children.
That's right.
That people don't think about.
That's exactly right. That's, yep. Although things have turned around a little bit in Ireland now, and that's slowed down a little bit.
Do you have any figures about population density and in relation to immigration? Because if you compare, for example, the population density of Germany or France to the United States, there's a vast difference, which brings things a little bit in the perspective. For example, one figure, a quarter in Germany, the territory of Germany, there was one quarter of the population of the United States. On a territory that is the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you can see that, that there seem to be at least more land and
space to absorb people here. Yeah. The problem with those density things is that it all depends on geography. About almost 50% of us live on the coasts, and then you got Iowa with people, you know, being depopulated. But you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up. This is how the legal immigration breaks down. You have a net of 680,000 to 730,000 of legal immigrants, 880,000 entering as legal. Now, you're a legal immigrant, right? Michael is. Or he would be. What's that?
What did you say
about
going to
church after all?
And then, but notice this, then 150 to 200,000 leave every year as legal immigrants. So that's an interesting reality that folks are leaving. Yes.
Are those returnees or U.S.?
Yes, some of them are people who legally immigrated and discovered that it ain't so easy to get rich here. Others are heading back to Canada saying, this ain't worth it. You know, give me better health care in Canada than this, than this junk.
But it's not U.S. citizens who are immigrating.
That's the exception, right? It's normally folks who have immigrated to the United States now immigrating back. Then this is the interesting one, and this is the figure that many argue about, is illegal immigration. The Population Reference Bureau is a big-time outfit, and they've looked at a lot of studies, and they say that we are netting only about 300,000 a year, but there's a flow of 1.5 to 2.5 million people per year who enter our country illegally. But then they leave for various reasons, primarily because they're migrant workers. They're working in our fields. They're picking the apples down lake, picking the vegetables that we eat here on the table. But every year, about 300,000 remain as permanent illegal settlers. Now, you can imagine that figure has to be somewhat fluid, huh? Pretty hard to really get a good sense of who is illegal and who isn't. They don't show up and raise their hands. But the best studies that they've been able to find indicate that. So put those two together, legal and illegal, and you have about a million people per year being added, which is about half of U.S. population growth today. We add about 2 million people a year. And the other million is chalked up to increased fertility, with about half of that being increased fertility among baby boomers like myself. In other words, we're having 3 or 4 children instead of 1 or 2, and slightly higher fertility rates among recent immigrant groups, whether they be legal or illegal. Okay, so you can see that even there's another little added dimension.
A lot of people think that they really big families, and they're really adding.
Yes, and that's primarily a myth than a reality. I'm sure there are always families to point to, but the studies indicate that their fertility rates are about two-tenths of a percentage point higher than the boomer generation. So we're about 2.28 and they're about 2.4, 2.5 on average. Okay, there was a huge wave of immigrants in the late 80s and early 90s. The peak of this wave was in 1991 when 1.8 million were legally admitted to the U.S. The reason for that is that nearly two-thirds of them came in under something called the 1996 Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was an attempt to provide legal residence to millions or many hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants who had wound up in this country and were living underground, and their health status was in jeopardy, just creating lots of problems for their own lives and for the communities that they live in. And so the country said it would be better to make them legal residents rather than to keep them under that pall of illegality. So in any case, that's one of the reasons why immigration is also a big issue today, is that so many were legally admitted in 1991 and have been since the late 80s. No, I think actually this sort of amnesty thing, or you know, this sort of program was the exception and not the rule. I think it's very, I think it may even be unprecedented. I don't remember anything else like that. But I'm not, I've really focused just on the last couple of decades. So I would defer to Deanna, she's shaking her head that it's basically unprecedented. So then in terms of categories of non-US citizens, this is how PRB breaks it down. Immigrants or legal aliens. They're always, that's one of the problems. We have lots of jargon here, and you have to understand what jives and what doesn't. Legal immigrants are citizens of other countries who have been granted a visa that allows them to live and work permanently in the United States. Some may become naturalized U.S. citizens. They are often referred to as green card holders. They are admitted on the basis of professional or job qualifications or family ties. And in this year, there's a ceiling of 675,000 people that can be admitted under this category, legally admitted to the nation as legal immigrants or legal aliens under this category. Then there's another category of refugees or asylees. These are people who have fled their country because they fear persecution for political, religious, or other reasons. The primary difference between refugees and asylees is refugees request permission to come to the United States before they leave their country. They go to the consulate, they go to the embassy, and they say, I want to come to the United States as a political refugee. And if they're lucky, they get someone to stamp their thing and they come. Asylees are those who request permission for safe haven after they arrive on our shores. The boat people from Haiti, many Salvadoran refugees during the Civil War in the 1980s. Now this number is also regulated annually. And in 1993, which is the only figure I could come up with, was 116,000 people were granted admission as refugees. Now, the United States basically only recognizes political refugees, not economic refugees. In other words, people fleeing poverty. So presumably, these 116,000 were granted admission as political refugees. However, this summer, the Jordan Commission, I mentioned that there's a group called the Jordan Commission that was created by Congress in 1990, part of an immigration bill to study U.S. immigration policy for the next 7 years, and they've been looking at illegal immigration, and now they're focusing on legal immigration. Anyway, this summer they said this category of refugees and asylees should be cut from about 100,000 per year to 50,000, cut in half. Well, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service wasn't too keen about that. Ralston Duffenbaugh just about dropped his jaw when he heard that was the recommendation of the commission. And the Clinton administration has indicated that they don't support that recommendation. I'm just throwing it out there so you are aware of this as a political development recently. I don't know how it's going to bail out. Of the Many, many people who apply for this, 80% are rejected. And the reason for that is the U.S. does not acknowledge economic refugees. We only take them as people fleeing religious or political persecution. And so 80% are rejected, but many of those who got here as asylees, in other words, you know, they left the country and then asked permission when they got here, managed to stay here illegally rather than to return home. 80% of them return or stay here rather than return home, and so they join that pool of illegal immigrants.
So, Jim?
Yes.
Do you know why the Jordan Commission suggested cutting it to 50,000? Was there an idea that these refugees and asylees didn't have just reasons for being here?
The only way I have become aware of that development was through the media, through press accounts, and unfortunately the press account only kind of reported the bare fat, you know, the bare stuff, and I didn't get the rationale. My guess is that it's out of a desire to curb total immigration to the United States, and as they try to cut it back, this is one category that they feel they can do it in. But that's not, you know, that's speculation on my part. I have not seen the jump.
I just wanted to say that you said half of all the immigrants in the world are to America.
That's what PRB says, is right. That the U.S. accepts about half of the world's immigrants every year.
But I think in this category, we're rather far down the list. The number of refugees we accept were very low.
Okay,
very good. Compared to, for example, Germany.
Okay, thank you.
So it's maybe a vulnerable category, a politically easy category to squeeze on.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, my expertise in this is minimal, so please jump in.
What's the deal with, you said that is expected that these people come as refugees, asylees, would return? You say they're staying as illegal immigrants, but they were, was the expectation when we take them in that they will return to their country?
I suppose if the political or religious persecution is lifted.
If they don't want to, then.
Michael?
See, the way it works is they arrive here. Everybody has, as soon as you enter the United States and ask for political
asylum,
you are entitled to a hearing.
Yep.
Every day at the JFK in New York, there are at least 50 to 100 people arriving. And what can they do? They are released, and then they have a hearing in a month, in 2 months, in 3 months, or whatever.
And they never show up.
I see.
Some are refused, as you said, 80% are denied the status of refugees. But since they have already their contacts here in the country, they just stay as immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Another comment I want to make, in the early 80s, there's a political factor there too, because I think Bush president said.
Well, Reagan was.
Reagan. They were taking in people from Poland who were not really political refugees. Our church took in a young
communist, people fleeing
I
communism.
I took a man and what would happen to if you stayed there? He stopped. Well, I'm undrafted. That really angered me because we thought we were taking in somebody who was really persecuted.
Yeah. U.S. Immigration and refugee policy is definitely a tool of politics. Don't get any fuzzy humanitarian notions here.
So think about this whole issue of who. When you start giving statistics, to make comparisons is very difficult because this is the sort of thing very difficult to keep track of. And we try and do retrospective studies of immigration and refugee numbers in the United States. What you'll realize is that records weren't kept very well until quite recently. So people who came in this sort of category, feeling that they were in some sort of political jeopardy, didn't used to have to go through this process. And to know whether someone came back for a hearing or not would have been even more difficult to track 10 years ago, 50 years, 100 years ago. And to come for, because you didn't want to get drafted, or talk about 19th century German immigration to the United States, that was a major reason for German immigration in the 19th century. But you just didn't have to apply for this category. There were other avenues. So the point is that comparisons across chronology are very difficult, partly because the information just isn't there, and partly because how things work has changed.
Thanks, Dan. There's a third category of non-immigrants. These are people who are officially granted temporary entry for a specific purpose. 21 million in 1993 is the most recent data I could come up with. Tourists are the majority, you know, show up to go to Disneyland or visit the Mall of America in Minneapolis. Millions by the day. Business visitors, 3 million. Foreign students, 257,000. And temporary workers. Now, there's a fourth category of unauthorized migrants, illegal aliens, unauthorized workers. This is that 2.5 to 2.5 million people who come across the border every year in one way or another seeking work. About half of these folks come across the border illegally, but the rest enter the country legally as tourists or students and then stay after their visas expire. So about half of that 2.5 million down in D are people who enter as tourists or students and then stay. And then the other half are estimated to be folks crossing the Rio Grande or coming in on boats. Or there was a trawler that beached and off the coast of New York with all these poor Chinese folks on it. It was terrible. Anyway, that gives you at least some sense of the different categories of folks.
Why is the temporary workers category so low compared to the others? I mean, if these people, 1.5 million, are coming a year and working in California or Texas or wherever.
Those are legally sanctioned temporary workers. Those are people who have the legal permission of the United States, and their employers have whatever the paperwork you need to bring a worker in to do a job, a temporary job. I don't know.
What I'm wondering is if there's so many employers hiring these people, why don't they push to make more of them legal?
Yes, and I think that's one of the directions that the U.S. is going to have to consider.
I think that's where there's a temporary requirement for certain skills and mechanics to fill within the USA at that moment.
Then you bring folks in.
It's extremely difficult to do all the paperwork for them. I mean, even people who are running for high office, you know, didn't do it for their nannies and stuff like that.
Yeah. All right, what's the demographic impact of immigration in the U.S., both legal and illegal? We have a national population growth rate of about 1.1%. As I said before, about a third of it is chalked up to, it's not quite right. This is in terms of the percent, but in terms of the actual number of people, about half of it is chalked up to this million or so people, and the other half of it is chalked up to increased fertility among recent immigrant groups and increased fertility among boomers like myself. So this is about 50% here, and then this is, I guess, you could say 25 and 25. I guess they should change that. It's unclear. If there is no further immigration today, if for somehow we could stop all immigration today, the United States population would reach 310 million by the year 2050, just at our current growth rate and fertility rates. However, with immigration at existing levels, we'll reach 383 million by the middle of the next century, which is a fairly sizable difference. I don't know what the math is there, probably just under 30% maybe, increased size, or 20%. And then the other thing we need to realize is that 75% of, now, say the 20 million foreign-born residents, this is a PRB term that I don't fully understand, but in any case, the bottom line is 75% of immigrants to the United States, whether legal or illegal, wind up residing in these states, California, New York, Florida, Texas, New Jersey, and Illinois. And of those, California handles 33% of the total. So you can understand why Californians are really wrestling with this issue. PRB says foreign-born estimated 42% of the children born in California in 1991. Ethnic and racial minorities formed less than 30% of the 1990 population, but accounted for more than 50% of the elementary school population. Again, that isn't necessarily because they have larger families. It's because most of those immigrants are young people, and they're having children.
Is that a public school or all school?
It just says elementary school, but I think it's public school. I think that would be the primary. Yes?
Do you know what the draw is to Illinois? And five of those are coastal states.
I know that Chicago is the second largest city of Salvadorans in the world. After San Salvador, then it's Chicago, or maybe Los Angeles, and then Chicago, and then you go back to a city in El Salvador. The same goes for, isn't it, Southeast Asian refugees? Aren't there many in Chicago? I don't know. There were certainly many Poles that went there in the 80s. So a lot of the Eastern European folks wound up in the Chicago area. And like I said, Salvadorans, so I imagine there are other Central Americans there as well. The pulls, well, you know, why New Jersey? I guess because it's closer to, you know, the shores and stuff. As you can see, they're primarily coastal towns, except for Chicago.
Well, New Jersey, too, you're just out of New York City.
Exactly, right. All right, now the ethnic mix of the United States, this is still PRB data. At our current immigration levels, if everything stays the same right now and continues in the indefinite future, by the middle of the next century, 50% of the country will be white folks, 33% will be Asians and Hispanics, and 14% African Americans. If immigration stops in 1983, or, you know, right about now, 61% whites, 22% Asians versus 33% and Hispanics, and then 17% African Americans versus 14%. The relationship between African Americans and other minorities in the country is a part of this population, or a part of this immigration debate, and some folks are trying to stoke those fires, trying to pit one group against the other. I encourage us to think about that, and whether that's a wise thing to promote, to pit one victim against another. But in any case, it's happening. Yes, sir.
Do you know why Asians and Hispanic are put in one group?
No, I don't. It was just the way that the data came. So I know they're obviously very different.
In California right now, I think it's about 56% non-Hispanic whites, and by the turn of the century, it will be under 50%.
Okay. Yeah, and that, you see, with a state that receives 33% of the country's total inflow, that makes sense that these statistics would be much more skewed. This is the national average.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of I saw the ratios recently between Asians and Hispanics, and they were both in the teens. I forget which, you know, one was 14, one was 18%.
That sounds about right.
I forget which was which.
Yeah.
I believe there's more Asians than there are Hispanics nationally.
Yeah, that could be. All right, this is just some public opinion regarding immigration. A 93 New York Times CBS poll, 61% favored reduced immigration, only 7% favored increasing immigration. Arguments in favor of immigration are some of the following. That we are, after all, a nation of immigrants. By the way, these are political arguments, not theological arguments. If we have time, I'll share some theological reflections on this question. But arguments in favor of immigration, you know, that we're a nation of immigrants. This isn't new. We've done this. This is why we are the country we are. That the global need to settle immigrants is greater than ever before. The world has never had larger numbers of refugees, for example. That immigration, when it all comes out in the wash, winds out to be a net economic gain for the nation rather than a drain for the nation, and that there is a strength and virtue to diversity. That one of the reasons the United States is the country it is because we are such a diverse group of people, and that there is a strength and virtue to that rather than a vice or a problem with it. Arguments opposed to immigration. There are many. Immigrants allegedly drive down wages and take away jobs. There is concern about the cost of including illegal immigrants in public assistance programs. There's an association or an assumption that urban crowding and congestion is somehow related to immigrants, or is related to immigrants. Rising tides of crime and violence are sometimes blamed on recent immigrants. There is a concern that immigrants who just got off the boat can receive preference in our society through affirmative action, when someone whose family has been here for generations would be the loser in a employment situation where affirmative action shows someone who's a racial or ethnic minority or woman. And that there's this general notion that they don't share American values. They're bringing the values from their culture, but they don't share our values, whatever those are. What's that?
Violence.
Greed. Never mind. I have a section here on Proposition 187 in which I just sort of describe the historical background, the substance of the proposition, some important factors related to it, and then arguments for and against it. Would you like me to go over that? Would that be helpful? Not for the Californian. Anybody else want to hear that? Otherwise, I could maybe. I'm sorry.
You said you had some theological ones.
Yeah.
Advanced. Sure. I tell you what. Let me just put this up, and you can just read it, and then I won't talk about it. All right? But you get a sense at least for it, for these, and then I can turn this overhead off. November 94 State Initiative. There's the substance to it. It was 59% voted in favor, 41% opposed it. My understanding is that it's currently in limbo, legal limbo, as state and federal judges are hearing various appeals regarding its constitutionality. But as near as I can understand it, this is the substance. Those are some important factors that related to it. And then those are arguments for and against it.
It's my understanding that some of the nurses and teachers in the system were just not going along.
Well, they one of the arguments was that nurses are hired to heal and teachers are hired to teach, and neither are hired to police or serve in reporting functions, which is what this would require. Okay, and then I also had some stuff on the Jordan Commission, but I think I'll bag that. Can I take that off? You all had a look at that? Or should I leave? I can leave it up and just in terms of some theological responses, Judeo-Christian theological response to immigration issues. I don't have a definitive position on this. I haven't thought it out yet. I regret the fact that I won't be here for the forum tonight, but it seems to me that there are at least five things that we could say about this. One is that when we reflect on immigration issues, it seems to me that Jews and Christians and those who spring from the lineage of Abraham need to reflect on the fact that the theme of journey, of sojourning, is deeply rooted in our tradition. A wandering Aramean was my father. The theme of journey and sojourning runs throughout our tradition, from the call of Abraham, which Bob Ekblad talked about last week, God calling Abraham and his family to migrate to Canaan, from the experience of the Hebrews, who were a minority population in Egypt, and when a new pharaoh was raised in the land, suddenly they became a persecuted minority. And experienced what it felt like to live in that condition and had to be liberated by Yahweh from that historical reality. The experience of the Exodus and the wandering in the wilderness is an experience of living a life as a refugee, living cut off from your home, being rootless, being torn apart, and uncertain of the future. There's just a lot of rich stuff in our tradition to at least resonate with the plight of those who are homeless and wandering. Other parts of our tradition is the mixed record of the conquest in Joshua and Judges when this group of wandering folks decides to suddenly move in and in some cases seize land from others, and in other cases sort of move in and manage to settle in fairly peaceably with neighbors. So our own tradition has some record of that as well, of sort of forcing ourselves upon others and in other cases adjusting well with others. After the rise of the kingdom came the fall of Judah and Israel, and with the fall came the exile. And Jews were spread around, homeless, torn apart from their history and background and families. After the exile came the journey of restoration. The exile was also part of the diaspora. So this theme of journey and movement is throughout our story. Shortly after Jesus is born in Matthew's gospel, he becomes a refugee and has to flee to Egypt for fear of Caesar, or Herod, I should say. And then after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, both Jews and Christians were forced to flee Jerusalem and to sojourn out and make it on their own somewhere else, and often go into a foreign land that maybe didn't want them. So that's one reality, is this theme of journey and the reality that Abraham was a wandering Aramean. Another is the related emphasis on hospitality to the stranger, which again Bob has been talking about in some of his Bible sessions. In a world of migrants and sojourners, which the ancient world was, hospitality became a mark of faithfulness and justice. The prophets made it very clear that though they reserved their greatest wrath for those who were inhospitable and who denied good favor to the poor and the vulnerable, to the sojourner. We need to remember that. It's harder for us now as a settled people, less migratory people, but that, at least then, was at the heart and center of a Judeo-Christian notion of justice, hospitality to the stranger. A third element for us to consider is the transnational character of Christian love, that Christian love knows no boundaries. It breaks down those boundaries. It breaks down the walls that divide us. Christ spoke to the Samaritan woman at the well, the first person to be, the first Gentile convert was Cornelius. The gospel has always extended, and Cornelius was a Roman centurion, a member of the oppressing Roman enemy. The Christian faith has always extended to all people. Our compassion has never been limited to the people of our own ethnic group or nationality or race. And that's another thing for us to reflect on. The parable of the Good Samaritan is one way that Jesus sort of sticks it to us, makes us realize that others are more righteous than we are. Just the whole theme of love of neighbor. What does it mean to really love our neighbor? The parable of the Good Samaritan is certainly clear about that. But then fifth, you know, as Lutheran, or I'm a Lutheran, and I have to do something with this two kingdoms doctrine and the distinction of law and gospel. One of the virtues of our Lutheran tradition is our strong affirmation that God works through the church, but also through our government, that justice is an act of God, and that governments are ordained by God to perpetrate justice and fairness in the world, and that it would be a disaster for the world to be ruled by the gospel and rather than by the sword, that we have to have a balance between those two. And so the church, it seems to me, has to respect the reality of government, the need for governments to make laws that are fair and which represent the ideals of the nation, but the government is not the highest law, and when those laws conflict with God's law, then Christians have in the past justified disobedience. But I think, however, that does require us to work aggressively in a democratic nation to pursue the kinds of policies that we think would embody the justice and fairness which is so central to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And only after those efforts have been tried and failed should we resort to acts of civil disobedience, whatever they may be. So that at least are, you know, five sort of thumbnail sketches of things: this emphasis on journey, the importance of hospitality to the stranger, the fact that Christian love and compassion know no national bounds, the importance of love of neighbor, and the reality that God does work through government and through law and through justice, and that we as democratic citizens have a role to play there as Christians as well. So why don't I turn this off and just open it up and see what else you folks want to say about this.
You mentioned as far as the paperwork when you're hiring for a work visa or whatever. We just hired a forester from Berlin, and one of the things that we have to go through as far as the paperwork is to make sure that the wages that we pay to him are equal in the industry. In other words, to avoid bringing people over to lower the income and that nature.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of federal law?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is just.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's well enforced, though, because in engineering, particularly, in the journals, you'll see advertisements for engineers with like a master's degree with salaries posted that are less than what a BA graduate or BS graduate would get. And I think those are people that are fishing for immigrants.
Yeah, I think it's up to the companies to monitor themselves. Us as a smaller company, we're able to keep control on that. Yet on the other hand, we've been in this issue pretty deep in the last 5 years. We're a forestry consulting firm, but we've also been hired by one of the major timber companies to do timberland security, which really isn't our niche, but since we know the ownership. And so we're dealing with the illegal immigrants on a daily basis. You know, we have meetings with immigration and whatnot. We're just really not sure ourselves just which way to go on the issue, how much efforts to put into it. I always get a conflicting opinion of myself, what is a justified Christian way to handle this, which really, I'm working for another company, and believe me, these larger companies really aren't too concerned with how I look at it from a Christian standpoint.
Sure.
So we always feel we're kind of right in the heat of things, which way to go. But your heart can't help but to be out for these folks. You know, they're out there, inclement weather. These larger timber companies hire, they've got, like you were mentioning, the best prices on labor type forestry work than they've had since the early 70s. They're just prospering on somebody's hardship as far as labor goes. So it's a touchy issue.
Yeah, Michael.
Jim, if you take this whole series together with what we said before, I think you want to make a connection, thinking that the world population is exploding.
Mm-hmm.
What are the prognoses in regard to people that seek immigration and illegal immigrants, particularly if you think that most of the population growth will happen in countries of the two-thirds world, and so all the pushing factors that you listed are right there.
Yeah, for those of you that weren't here, I've done other sessions on global population growth and some other related issues. 95% of all future population growth will take place in the nations of the developing world, or the two-thirds world, or whatever the language is that is most comfortable with you or most clear. And I have not seen data on real good projections on what that's going to do to the refugee stream, other than, I think, we're looking at a doubling of the world's population probably by the middle of the next century, unless the world gets its act together in a big way, which might have reason for concern. Which I think would mean that we're looking at probably at least a doubling of the world's refugee flow. either from economic, political, and now ecological reasons. And what that will mean for the United States and other recipient countries is hard to say, but at this point we seem to be heading in the opposite direction. We seem to be trying to shut those doors rather than open them. So this is not an issue that's going to go away. This issue is going to get worse. We're going to have more people in boats, and not just in the United States, but they're going to be heading across the seas and in Europe and landing in nations there. The Jordan Commission, one of the things that the Jordan Commission is arguing for is an increase of U.S. foreign aid with particular attention to eradicating poverty and rural landlessness. The primary reason people flee leave the countryside is because they can't sustain their lives there. And one of the main reasons they can't sustain their lives there is they don't have legal access to the land. They are tenant workers, or they've been forced off land by larger landholders. But right now, Jonathan could speak to this, the battles in Congress are such that 30 to 35% of the United States, or 25 to 30% of the United States development assistance budget, which is the portion that does this kind of work in our foreign aid bill, has now been cut out. So we've already lost 20 to 25 thousand of what's the total? 3-4 million?
5 billion.
5 billion, excuse me.
I was going to say on this point that, you know, foreign aid is partly responsible for an improvement in child mortality and literacy, which you related very directly to population control measures. You were saying the best way to control population is to teach women how to read.
Yeah. Give them many other opportunities.
Many others. Yeah, in terms of opportunities and so on. And those things have been positively impacted by foreign aid. So at the time when this problem is coming into focus, we are cutting foreign aid to the countries where the population is going to explode. Yeah. And it has made a difference. And so we're sticking our head in the sand twice, really, by closing the borders and saying that we don't have to worry about what happens in Africa or in South Asia. And over against the other things we're doing with foreign aid, for example, keeping everything that goes to Israel and Egypt, it's you can call it lunacy, and you're not crazy to use that word.
What foreign aid is what, about 13 billion or 12 billion?
It depends, because they count in the State Department budget, and they count in USAID, the Information Agency, Voice of America, things like that. But it's about 13 to 15 billion. Mm-hmm. It's about 1% of the federal budget.
Mm-hmm. And of that,
part of it, which is humanitarian, is less than 0.5% of the federal budget, about $5 billion. And that's the part that's getting cut. You know, as they look for pennies to save in Washington, they're cutting the aid to the poorest countries.
Just like
keeping the aid to Ukraine or Israel or some pet areas. And we're already the least generous of the industrialized countries. America is the least generous of the 22 or 28 OECD industrialized countries, the first world par excellence. We're the lowest percentage of our federal budget that goes for foreign aid. If you're a Dane, ask Sven and Elizabeth, $900 of your tax bill goes to foreign aid. $900 of the taxes you pay to Uncle Spent, goes to foreign aid. Because Denmark, Norway, Sweden tried to reach this 0.7% of GNP, which is an international standard set by the UN. If you're an American, $44 of your tax bill goes to foreign aid. That's all.
I have a comment, because this is one thing that stirs me up, the Lutheran Church in particular, because we don't want it to be anything political, right? But the Christians really wrote letters to Congress and said, I object to that. Mm-hmm. That could be changed.
Bread for the World.
I remember Bread for the World, and of course that's one of the things that we try to do, to get a listening ear in our congregations, because it's almost impossible.
Yeah, Americans have in large measure abandoned our democratic process. 39% voted in the last election. That's one place to address this issue, is by taking our democratic privileges seriously.
Well, there are many Lutherans who vote to cut foreign aid.
Yes,
there, were many, there were many Lutherans in Sandy, in California, who voted for Prop 187.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to imply that we aren't. We don't
because
have different ideologies.
We Lutherans are part of the voters of this country. So.
Yeah, we're probably among the conservative majority. Did you have a question?
Well, and I was going to say
observation.
When we look at the country as a whole, the population of the country that's Christian as opposed to the population of the country that isn't has been changing too. If you look at the, if you take a percentage now, whether you want to justify going to church or attending church as a qualifier for being Christian, but a lot of people have no church connection that live in the United States, where it used to be almost everybody went, was part of a Christian community. And I think sometimes without this exposure, I know it started already with my generation, without this exposure to this type of atmosphere where you discuss it and think about how you're going to feel, you tend to become more selfish and see only what it, how it affects your life. And in that sense, you are going to vote differently. And you're also, the population, if the population decreases that attend a Christian community, where like the Lutherans have Lutheran World Relief, for instance, if that population drops that gives to a charitable thing like this, then you're going to end up with less support for the needy in the long run. That's what I feel.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other comments? Or, yes, Bob.
Do you know how much money goes to support the INS? And do you know how much that's increasing? Like, I've heard that in the last 6 months, they've doubled the number of border patrol workers on the California-Mexican border.
Yeah, one of the... One of the things that the Jordan Commission is calling for is a border entrance fee. Let's see if I get that. To impose a border crossing fee to raise revenues to increase border management, which would be the INS, and to establish rapid response teams for quick containment of new attempts at illegal crossings. So I don't know what the number of the budget is.
Actually, that was tried already, and it was killed again. There was a
Okay. Border
fee going into and from Canada, and
yeah.
People went just crazy over it.
Right.
And it was stopped.
Yeah, I think this is an idea that comes up every now and then and gets voted down
yeah.
or gets certain ways.
In the, when you travel by air, you don't realize how much you pay for. For immigration and so on. I think it's for an international ticket you pay about $70 to $35 for paying the INS agent who puts a stamp in your passport. Most people don't realize because it doesn't show up. And so
sure. Thank you. Yeah.
I was just thinking after what you said on the other side of the room, it was either last year or the year before our church's annual meeting going over the budget, the question actually came up. You know, we have a lot of good local outreach programs. Why do we send money to Lutheran World Relief? And why do we pay dues to the ELCA? You know, why shouldn't we just... And there was, you know, it ended up, you know, being somewhat of an explanation. But it was brought up and maybe... Because nobody in the local congregation, you know, was brought up as a legitimate question. You know, why do we spend so much money out of our budget to these organizations instead of just spending the money locally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a big need for interpretive work on the part of our national church agencies and bodies to communicate what, in fact, they do with our funds. And there's a lot of very, very good work being done.
If I could just...
He's the one who does it for LWR.
No, but a caller on a radio show put this very question. You know, you always hear it, you know, help those needy around, because people are conscious of the need around them. And not myself, who was the guest, but the radio woman herself said, after a comment earlier, she said, look at Denmark. It not only helps the rest of the world much more than other countries, but it also helps its own citizens. Those who help overseas also help locally. I mean, the fact is we can do both. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
The amount that goes to all those Lutheran institutions and the ELCA is hardly better than Uncle Sam. It sends something like 2% overseas.